This episode is brought to you by Southern Farm and Garden, a beautiful handcrafted agricultural journal. Subscribe today at southernfarmandgarden.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
It is time for What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am absolutely bubbling over with energy because I just spent almost a week out of New York City and deep in the country getting those microbial, endorphin boosters from the soil or whatever it is. Anyway, this is me, your host, Katie Kiefer. We have a great show today. We're talking about the future of farming in this country, something that most people don't really think about all that much. But, you know, remember back in the day of Farm Aid, no farmers, no food. Yeah, that's really true. So, but before we get there, we are now here. And here is Joy and Sorrows. And really, this is turning into not really joys and sorrows so much. It's just kind of stuff that catches my attention during the week. And then I put it down or I save the link. But the first one I wanted to talk about, partly because I got to do a radio show with Marion Nessel last weekend, Michael Olson's show, The Food Chain, out in California. And she and I were co-guests, which was a real thrill for me, I must say. I was deeply gratified. And of course, Marion is wonderful as always. And she was being asked about her book, Soda Politics, which I interviewed her for about a year or so ago when it came out. Anyway, I wanted to, because of that, I was thinking about Marion and my eye was caught by this article in the Wall Street Journal, which reported that bottled water now rules over soda. Between safety concerns over tap water and the public health implications of drinking sugary drinks, Adam's Ale has prevailed. Don't you like that? Isn't that cute? And that is a development that the American Beverage Association could not possibly have anticipated. Even a decade ago, probably even 5 years ago, they wouldn't have seen that to be the prevailing trend. But there it is. And if you want to learn more about why we are winning the war against soda, read Marion's book, Soda Politics. It's really excellent. And the tagline in it is, but we are winning. And she's right. We are winning. So there's a joy. Okay. There's a joy for you. Now, the second thing I wanted to talk about is something I have brought up on this show quite often over the years, like really over many years now, because this is my 8th year of broadcasting on the Heritage Radio Network. And that is the end of the GPSA rule. Now, GPSA, I talk about periodically. It's kind of a murky situation, but it's actually GPSA stands for Grain Inspection Packers and Stockyards Act, which was signed into law decades ago, but was kind of revamped and reformed, and a newer version of which was approved by the Obama administration last year with the idea of helping to level the playing field for smaller livestock farmers who are literally strangled by the iron grip of gigantic meatpacking corporations who control the pricing for livestock. The rule, which Obama approved, would have made it easier for livestock producers to sue the large meat processing companies that they contract with over their abusive practices, like beating them down on price for their animals. Mr. Trump's USDA has put the rule on ice for a minimum of 6 months and may very well kill it once the fuss dies down. And it's to be remembered that the people who hate this rule are the people who donate the most to the members of Congress. So the rule has been challenged by the likes of the National Pork Producers Council, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, the National Chicken Council, and other large trade organizations that represent the interests of people like Tyson, Cargill et al. So if you want to know why this rule is so important, you might want to go back and take a listen to a recent show that I did with Christopher Leonard on the price fixing lawsuits that have been waged against big chicken processors by a variety of different groups. And that is why the rule is important. So take a listen to that show if you haven't listened to it before, because Chris, of course, is a wonderful journalist who is my guru in a way because of his incredible book, The Meat Racket. which blew open the practices of the poultry industry and the very abusive nature of those practices. So definitely take a listen to that or just read up on it. But it has a big implication for the smaller livestock farmers who really are struggling to find outlets for their product that aren't just farmers markets. Okay, and lastly, a year ago in March, 71 investment firms wrote to 10 major food companies warning them that they must take meaningful action to curb or eliminate the routine use of antibiotics in the food chain. And since then, most of them are, in fact, actively working to make that happen. And that includes producers as well. Tyson has made great efforts. Purdue has really gone way, way beyond anybody else in removing antibiotics from their food chain. But the companies in question are largely fast food companies or restaurant chains. They include McDonald's, the Darden Restaurants, Brinker International, Domino's Pizza, J.D. Weatherspoon, some of these are European, Mitchell's and Butler's, Restaurant Brand International, The Restaurant Group, Wendy's, and Yum! Exclamation point, which is the owner of KFC, Taco Bell, et al. What was interesting, what caught my eye about this is that all of these other chains, responded to the investment companies saying, yes, they are doing this. Yes, they understand the implications of not doing it. And yes, they can issue reports on the progress that they're making. But Yum! Exclamation point, did not respond to the request for information about their efforts, which leads one to believe that they really aren't making any. And it should be noted that Yum! Exclamation point is expanding enormously in Asia, where excess use of antibiotics is literally a national emergency. And it is one where finally the government is stepping in China and trying to regulate the use of antibiotics, because at this point we have reached the end of the road. It was in China that the first antibiotic-resistant microbes to the final drug in our arsenal, colistin, was discovered first, and that has been replicated in other countries. But certainly the Chinese literally use billions of pounds of antibiotics every year in their livestock industry, which is all completely modeled on the American. And you can learn more about that, my friends, when you purchase my book, which is available now on Amazon. It's called What's the Matter with Meat? And I have a big, long chapter about China. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. I'm, you know, what is that? You know, when you blow on your knuckles and then rub your chest. I forget what that expression is for that, but that's what I'm doing. So now we will take a short break and we will be right back with Lindsay Lusher Shute. I hope I said that correctly. She is the executive director and co-founder of the National Young Farmers Coalition. We're going to be talking about the future of food in the United States. So stay tuned and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Southern Farm and Garden, a beautiful, handcrafted agricultural journal. Each issue features stories about food history, seasonal recipes, artisanal products, and the amazing people who bring it to your table. Packed with stunning photography, the content is fresh and educational. Southern Farm and Garden takes you behind the scenes to meet farmers, gardeners, wineries, chefs, and artists who are passionate about creating healthy, unique, and sustainable food and products that you can enjoy all year. Are you interested in eating healthier and learning more about where your food comes from and living a more connected life? Subscribe today to southernfarmandgarden.com. Foodtank.com names Southern Farm and Garden one of the top 20 magazines for people who eat, cook, and grow, praising it for connecting readers with the food, the farms, and the stories behind our food system. Subscribe today or find a retailer near you at southernfarmandgarden.com.
Hey, like what you hear? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. With fresh programming every week, we've got something for everyone. Trying to start your own food business? Concerned about where your food comes from? Looking for the best wine or beer to bring to a party? Find our shows on iTunes or Stitcher, or head to heritageradionetwork.org to listen live and subscribe to our newsletter.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and we're going to be talking about the National Young Farmers Coalition with their executive director and co-founder, Lindsay Lusher Shute. Welcome to the show, Lindsay. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Katie.
You're welcome. I'm just going to read your bio, which I forgot to do. I normally do that before I bring you on, but you'll have to bear with me while I extol your virtues to my public. Lindsay, you have a background in organizing. Of course, I can't see this. In organizing and state policy, Lindsay co-founded National Young Farmers Coalition as a platform for young progressive farmers to have meaningful influence on the structural obstacles in the way of their success. Lindsay is a respected speaker and an expert on the structural issues facing family farms. In 2014, she was named a champion of change by the White House. She and her husband own and operate Hardy Roots Farm in the Hudson Valley. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much. Okay. Thanks. Nice CV there. You didn't make me feel too bad about myself. Normally when after I introduce somebody, I then feel like, but you know, you have a manageable CV. I'm totally impressed with you because I suspect you're way, way younger than I am and already running a farm and a national coalition for young farmers. So tell us about the National Young Farmers Coalition. Like, what is this? What are you doing? And why did you start it?
Sure. The National Young Farmers Coalition was founded by myself and a couple farmers in the Hudson Valley in 2010. Because of the structural issues that we were facing in building our farms, essentially from scratch, all first-generation farmers. And we realized that there was no local or regional or even national organization that was really representing the needs of young and beginning farmers trying to break into agriculture. And so we got together with farmers, young farmers across the country, and launched the coalition then, and now we have grown the organization to 34 chapters in 29 states and thousands of members that work on policy change, primarily in D.C., although we have some state initiatives that are beginning right now. We also offer business services, technical training, and support to our members, and then we offer business networks and community through our chapters.
Sounds great. I mean, incredible. And especially the fact that you grew it so quickly says something about the need for that. So tell us, what are the biggest challenges faced by would-be young farmers? I mean, I would guess that it's acquisition of land, but I'm sure there's much more to it than that.
That's right. Land remains the number one challenge for farmers nationwide, for different reasons, depending on the region, but the primary issue for young people getting into agriculture really is the cost per acre and how the economics just don't necessarily line up. You know, if you're paying $10,000 an acre for land, it's pretty hard to pay back that mortgage on a farmer's income. So that's the challenge we're facing. And also some of the farms at this point in time are so large. They've been consolidated over decades. And so there's also some community and interpersonal stuff that comes into play that's sort of layered on top of just the basic price and economic issues, that these are family farms, many of them. And so to have a new owner, it can be very complicated to make that transition between generations and, you know, sometimes, you know, subdividing a farm or whatever it might require to, you know, get maybe that first 100 acres or maybe that first 10 acres, whatever the case might be, for a young person to get going.
What is the average size of a young farmer's, you know, let's talk about your constituency. What, how much land are they looking to acquire to start their farming operations? Is it something like 10 acres, or is it 100 acres, or is it somewhere in between?
Right. It absolutely depends on the region. We have urban farmers that are part of our network that may be doing a quarter acre. And then we have farmers who are working in the western landscape doing ranching, and they're on the scale of thousands of acres. Uh-huh. I would say on average, I would say most of our members are probably like in the 50 acre sort of a range. Mm-hmm. But it really very much depends on the context in which they're farming. My farm is 70 acres. Every season we farm about 25 acres of vegetables, and we have some livestock as well.
So what are the ways that your organization supports young farmers? You said you mentioned business, business education. What's the average age of the person who's trying to get into farming, and if they're not sort of generational, what's their background in general, have you found?
Right. So the average age of people getting into farming, that's a good question. I will say that our sort of core constituency is between the age of 25 and 35. Mm-hmm. Young people in their 20s, sometimes they've done other careers. They've graduated from high school or college and have tried a few other things and sort of fallen into farming one way or another by getting a job at a farm or meeting some farmers and feeling inspired or, you know, reading about sort of the good food movement and feel like they want to be a part of that. They want to be an active member of their community in that way. And so they get into farm careers in their 20s, and because so many of them are coming from non-farming backgrounds, the majority of the farmers in our coalition are first-generation farmers. They are not inheriting knowledge, skills, even rural community, and certainly land, and so they're really starting from scratch. Multi-generational farmers, they face a different set of challenges that can, frankly, be as equally or more difficult. But the folks that seem to gravitate toward our coalition at this point, many of them are completely new to agriculture and so are starting from square one. The coalition, the way that most people come into our coalition and experience what we do at first is generally through our chapter network. We have events on the ground organized by farmers, a lot of farmer-to-farmer education, farm tours, potlucks, that type of thing. Uh-huh. And so those are happening in our 34 chapters around the country. And those chapters essentially form our grassroots network that feeds into our policy work, primarily in D.C. at this point. So we take the needs that we're hearing on the ground from young and beginning farmers, and those flow up into a policy platform. And right now we're in farm bill season, so One of the big services that we're offering for our farmers is essentially working with them in partnership to elevate their voices to get their needs heard by this Congress and hopefully the next Secretary of Agriculture and the administration. So right now, for instance, in the budget process, we're fighting very hard for programs that they have come to depend on, whether that's loans or conservation programs. Those are the types of needs that we're able to bring directly to USDA and Congress. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the initial sort of wins that we made through this theory of change, through, you know, working with our grassroots network and on up to USDA was early on in the coalition, we convinced the USDA to start a micro-lending program for all farmers. And previously, the USDA, the Farm Service Agency, was very good at giving large loans to farmers. And we said, not everybody needs $100,000 or more. Some people just need $10,000. And so They actually initiated a new loan program, a micro-lending program, that's now served over 20,000 farmers all across the country. So those kinds of things, looking at existing USDA programs and seeing how they can sort of be tailored or remade for the beginning farmer. Uh-huh. And also defending some of those programs when they go through Congress, and some of them are, you know, proposed for cuts and that type of thing. And then lastly, we give support on the ground through business services. Right now, we're doing credit education with farmers. Mm-hmm. We have a cooperative agreement with the Farm Service Agency, so we teach all about federal lending programs. And we also are teaching food safety classes with the National Farmers Union. Right now we're focused in the southeastern region and are giving classes to small-scale vegetable growers on how they can work up to or immediately comply with the Food Safety Modernization Act.
Uh-huh, right. So obviously regional differences are going to dictate what people are growing, but what are you seeing as trends in what kinds of areas young farmers are pursuing? Like, are you seeing a lot of organic growers, or are you seeing people who focus on heirloom varieties of vegetables and fruits, or heritage breeds of livestock? I mean, or are they mixed-use farms, for example, or are they pursuing one type of farm? I mean, you said you yourself have 25 acres of vegetables, and then you have some livestock, so you're a mixed-use farm, I guess, right? What's the most prevalent trend that you see?
That's a great question. Yeah, we're in the process of doing a survey of, and we'll be releasing the results in a couple of months here, and that will give us a really clear picture of what our farmers are growing and where and at what scale. But I'll say, generally speaking, and from what we know of our coalition, the majority of those farmers are using sustainable organic practices. Mm-hmm. Not as many of them are certified organic as the number that use organic practices, but have not, you know, received certification yet, and that's for a number of reasons, including they might be on land that is not cannot be certified organic yet because it's sort of in that transition phase.
Right.
So we have a majority of our farmers are doing certified organic or somewhere in between, and many of them are running highly diversified operations, so they're doing vegetables and livestock together. Mm-hmm. I would say most of our farmers also are doing direct market, so they're selling direct to consumer. They're doing farmers markets, they're doing CSAs. Some of them are getting more into the wholesale business as they achieve a little bit of scale, and they're a little bit further on into their careers. But most of the young farmers in our network in particular are using those direct market channels because it's the easiest way for them to scale from, you know, maybe that acre, quarter acre, you know, up, because you have a CSA community network behind you, and you're getting through CSA or farmers market, you're getting the highest margin on your products.
Right, that's what I was thinking. It's like you don't have a middleman, so you're not getting beat down on price for your livestock.
Right.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And are farmers markets, CSAs, growing commensurately to support the number of new, how many new farmers are coming into your coalition every year, do you think?
I'm not sure that I have a perfect answer for that, but I would say at least hundreds of new farmers are coming in. Our whole network now is over 100,000 young people around the country that are, you know, part of our supporter network. So we are seeing a growing number of young people coming into agriculture. In fact, up to 2007, from I think it's 1910 to 2007, the number of young people in agriculture has steadily decreased.
Yes.
And it was only in between 2007 and 2012 was there a small uptick in the number nationally in the number of owner operators that are young, under 35. And so it's a slightly measurable trend. I mean, there was only, I think, 1,200 during that period of time, 1,200 new operators. And unfortunately, at the same time between those 2 years, 2007 and 2012, nationally we lost over 90,000 operators overall. But there was a slight increase in the number of young people in agriculture, which is a good thing.
Oh, yeah.
And it's certainly not enough, but things are hopefully slowly turning around in terms of how young people are perceiving the career of agriculture. In terms of, you know, is CSA and farmers market, are those growing along with the numbers of new farmers, we'll say? And I would say definitely we have experienced a continuous trend of growth on our farm. We sell to New York City and the Hudson Valley region. We have continued to grow our market share within CSA. We've continued to grow the numbers of people, consumers, local folks buying our products through CSA at those locations. I would say in some locations, some towns, particularly more rural places, there is definitely sort of a saturation point that some people are sort of feeling where CSA is not for everybody. And so, you know, that has pushed CSA to become a little bit more flexible for consumers. There's a little bit more choice. There's a little bit more, purchasing flexibility. Mm-hmm. You don't have to pay all up at once in the springtime, but you can pay in an installment program. So I think CSA has changed a little bit, and consumers, I think, have stuck with it. And I think overall there's probably been growth. But it's not necessarily going to be the thing that's going to scale farmers markets. I would say it's kind of the same thing. Mm-hmm. In some places, farmers markets have continued to grow because there is a population to support those markets. In more rural markets, it's a little bit more difficult when people have their own like home gardens and there's farm stands and whatnot. Right. But farmers are finding a way. They're finding their niche. Some of the farmers in our network are also really looking to restaurants. Some are looking to schools as an outlet for sales. So they're definitely, the movement itself is expanding that market. They're trying to push the limits and find ways to make the farmers market or CSA, I think, a better product, really, for the consumer audience at large.
Uh-huh. Very interesting. What about the diversity issue? How much diversity, ethnic diversity, do you see in your cohort of young farmers, of young people coming into the profession?
Right. Well, overall, the USDA has several different ways of counting who's in agriculture. One of those ways is owner-operators of farms, and owner-operators of farms is predominantly white. It's a white population, and that is somewhat reflected in our own coalition, and we have been working very hard over the last year to ensure that our coalition, our programs, the things that we're working on are relevant to farmers of color.
Because you have Karen Washington on your board, right?
There's broad recognition that, the farmers, the people who are actually picking the food in across the country are predominantly farmers of color, the farm worker population.
Sure.
And I have spoken many times about, this idea that we just need to figure out pathways, for those very talented farm workers to find citizenship, to have a permanent home here in the United States. But those workers also need to find a way to become farm owners because there's so much talent in that community that can fill a lot of these vacancies that we're seeing at large within the farm community, these owner-operators who are retiring and leaving their farms.
Right. I'm thinking that probably the biggest barrier, aside from the, immigration status, is whether or not you can secure a loan. And that seems to be definitely skewed toward a white population, no matter what anybody says. So I expect that until that changes, that's going to be the biggest barrier to entry. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would say that the Farm Service Agency has made a lot of strides in terms of trying to make sure that they are giving access to their lending programs to all farmers. There have been well-documented problems in the past, lawsuits and whatnot, so clearly there have been issues, but I feel like, at least on the federal side, they have tried quite hard to reform some of those programs under the last Secretary of Agriculture in particular.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
but one of the problems that we see is, so for the immigrant population, undocumented population, you cannot get a loan from the Farm Service Agency unless you're a citizen of the United States. And I don't see that being something that is going to likely change in my lifetime. It would be pretty tough to get that rule changed, but that doesn't mean we can't offer a path for citizenship for a lot of these farm workers that are on the ground that have so much to offer.
Yeah, I would think so. I would think that could, potentially be like a deal that you make, that you agree to do this and will agree to do that. But let's talk for a second about because I want to get into more of the federal issues that you guys address. But the recent, what caught my eye and what led me to invite you to the show was the press release that your organization sent out about the budget proposal from the Trump administration that included a 21% cut to the USDA. And that would include a discretionary spending. It's not a cut to the farm bill yet, but it's just to their discretionary funding. What do you think that will mean for your cohort in particular, and then maybe to farmers in general? Is that going to have more of an impact on the big ag guys, or is it going to have more of an impact on your people?
That's a good question.
I'm so glad you like my questions.
I can see for how it would impact the farmers in our network. They depend on, we've just been talking about credit programs and the Farm Service Agency. they depend on the Farm Service Agency to give them credit. Oftentimes, the Farm Service Agency is the only bank that will lend to young farmers because they're going into farming, which is inherently risky. And by the way, they're new farmers. So they're even more in a position of risk because they're learning to farm while they're farming. So the Farm Service Agency is absolutely critical to new and beginning farmers, and some of the cuts would potentially affect the Farm Service Agency's ability to loan to farmers for either operating loans, the loans that farmers need on sometimes an annual basis to get their farms up and running in the beginning of the season, to farm ownership loans, which and down payment loans, which allow farmers to buy farms, as you would expect. It also could affect the guarantees that the Farm Service Agency gives to other banks that enables other banks, like Farm Credit, to lend to farmers. So they share some of that risk, the Farm Service Agency, with banks. So it would have a very devastating effect for farmers seeking credit, which is most farmers, right?
Absolutely.
The other programs that it could potentially hit would be conservation programs. And down to, like, the individual conservation specialist, offering technical support to farmers at the Natural Resources Conservation Services offices all around the country. So those are the offices. They usually sit next to the Farm Service Agency, sometimes right next to extension agents. And these are folks that help to deliver conservation programs on the ground to all farmers. Mm-hmm. And so there's been cuts that have been proposed to those offices. So you would have fewer people on the ground helping farmers gain access to those programs. And I'll tell you from our own experience with the current funding levels, our local guy, our NRCS guy, is just booked. I mean, it's very hard to get on his radar and get his attention. And I mean, he's super helpful, but he just has so many farms that he is supposed to be supporting. And even at existing levels, I mean, they're really stretched thin to help all of the farmers in their region. So the programs that come through NRCS are things like the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, EQIP. That program offers a high tunnel cost-sharing program that is likely one of the most popular programs that our farmers use right now because they're looking to use high tunnels for season extension. Oftentimes, with issues of climate change and increased disease pressure, we now put all of our tomatoes, for instance, under a high tunnel like this. So some of these programs, they incentivize good practices on farms, but they are also, they have become a very important way for farms to become capitalized, to build up that infrastructure at the outset when farms are just beginning. Young and beginning farmers are really depending on these programs. And the last thing through NRCS that is a very big deal for our farmers is land conservation, funding for land trusts to buy development rights off of farms to permanently protect land as farmland to ensure that it doesn't become, I guess, a big box store or subdevelopment, that these prime soils are protected as farms. And that funding would be potentially cut as well, the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program. That's a program that we have been really trying to get behind because of this issue of land transition right now. It's estimated that two-thirds of all of the farmland in the United States is going to transition within the next 2 decades, meaning that it's going to need a new owner because of the average age of farmers.
Yes, I read 93 million acres. I'm actually going to be, I'm writing an article about land grabbing in the United States.
Oh, great.
And 93 million acres will change hands within the next 5 years. So you know,
there you go.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. So that is, I mean, it does make, it makes a rather compelling case for these conservation programs.
Right.
You guys have worked a lot in the federal arena. We talked a little bit about the loan programs. One of the things that you mentioned on your website is that the Farm Services Administration should have specially trained agents. That's what you were talking about with the guy who's super booked and who may, in fact, experience even more loss of, you know, bandwidth in terms of how much funding there is for that. But those are the agents you were talking about who assist young and beginning farmers in county offices or specialists who serve multiple offices in a region. Like
that's right. So the Farm Service Agency, USDA has many, is the big umbrella. And then there are the sub agencies underneath, and Farm Service Agency is one of those agencies. And then there's the Natural Resources Conservation Service and RCS. That's actually a different agency, and they both have offices with people in them.
Right.
The Farm Service Agency, that agency has actually deployed beginning farmer specialists now in select regions around the country. And those beginning farmer specialists are something that we have advocated for, because they are out in the field intended to help young and beginning farmers get ready to apply to the Farm Service Agency and help support agents on the ground with the applications of new and beginning farmers. One of the other challenges that we've faced is we have this influx of young people who want to run highly diversified farms, direct market farms, that these are business models that haven't been seen in maybe a generation or two at the Farm Service Agency.